Welcome to Postscript, the podcast where I mansplain film theory to my boyfriend and make him respond in real time without letting him prepare at all. I'm Tori.
And I'm David, the boyfriend.
This season is about what makes a good or bad act one of a movie. So let's get started with some basics.
That was pretty good. I like that. I like that you're mansplaining to me.
I thought you would like it.
Mm-hmm. I like that you put an emphasis on me reacting in real time without preparation.
Well, I thought you might appreciate them knowing that.
I really, really appreciate that.
So, the classic hero's journey structure, you know, the Joseph Campbell hero with a thousand faces thing. I'm just going to kind of go through that real quick.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of movies like Star Wars, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, you've got a main character who's kind of living their normal life, just like you, you know, but feels they are destined for greater things and they aren't fulfilling their full potential. And usually in these stories, they don't know their true origins, like in all three that I mentioned. They're being raised by their aunt or uncle. And part of that is kind of like they don't feel like they really belong. There's some kind of mystery about like what their reason, you know, for existing is, or there must be something else or greater out there. And then there's like this inciting action. Someone shows up, tells them they're unique or special somehow, and they're the only one suited for this adventure or quest, or the only one, you know, your only hope kind of moment. And then they have to make a decision about whether or not they're going to like leave their boring life behind and embark on a journey that will change them forever. And act one ends when they choose to accept this journey. There's some variation in the lead up to this, even in like these standard movies, but we'll kind of go back to that later.
Yeah. I mean, seems obvious, but also a lot of movies seems to fail to
mm-hmm.
do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And another interesting question, are there any great examples that are not doing that, but it's still working?
Yeah, and let me know if you think of anything, you know, that sticks out to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is going through, you know, a lot of, especially in this episode, I'll go through a lot of films that are clearly following the standards,
mm-hmm.
you know, not trying to stray from that. But there are many other ways to make an interesting story,
mm-hmm.
many other things that can work. Although it's surprising how often it does go back to these key elements.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even movies that are, you think of as being very alternative or
experimental.
Like if you took like A Field in England, for example, I had another one in mind. But yeah, something like that, it would actually go back to this main mm-hmm. idea, you know? You might yeah. think of it as being something extremely
It's not really the narrative that's weird in A Field mm-hmm. in England. It's still like
yeah.
pretty much like going from point A to B to C. Like
yeah.
it's still a very narrative way to tell a story.
Yeah.
It's more like the trippy scenes that are happening that are confusing there.
Yeah, and I think
not the structure of the script.
I think that's what's counterintuitive is like some movies that are extremely like mundane in their subject matter have really strange narrative journeys. Whereas sometimes movies where you would immediately think like that's a weird movie, like a David Lynch movie or something. I think you actually could take even something like Mulholland Drive and put, you know, like bring it back to this kind of formulaic narrative structure, as strange as that is.
Yeah, because it's not really the structure, even with Mulholland Drive. It's not the structure that's weird in that movie.
Yeah.
And yeah, it would be interesting to see like what kind of movies not using the structure.
Yeah.
Because the only thing, the only example I can think of is like the sketch movies, like something like
Night
Night on Earth.
Yeah, I was thinking
just like restart the characters and the plot and everything in every single section.
Right. And I wonder if there's an overarching kind of a meaning or narrative created and the order of those smaller stories does follow kind of an overarching arc. You know what I mean?
Yeah. If I think of Night on Earth, for example, it's definitely, they put a lot of emphasis on the opening sequence that it's a taxi and the character is getting in the taxi and they start a conversation there. And in the later episodes, we're already in the taxi. We already have the passenger in the car.
So in other words, it's establishing something about the world that we're in.
So it's still, yeah, it's still, exactly.
In the beginning. So it's, yeah. So another classic example of this is The Matrix. It's...
How come?
I know it's shocking.
Unfortunately, no one can be told what The Matrix is.
Actually, yeah, The Matrix is one of the most commonly used to teach this, or just teach sort of narrative beats in film, because it is like to the letter, by the book, perfectly timed.
And also, as you mentioned it, I just realized that in Star Wars... how late they introduce Luke Skywalker, even though it's meant to be one of those very classic examples of this type of narrative. But a lot is happening in the movie before the main character is being introduced, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Considering how standard of an example that is to this formula.
Yeah. That's not necessarily unusual either, though. A lot of them, and I'll come back to this later, but a lot of them start with something, don't start with the main character. That's pretty common. Lord of the Rings is the same way.
I mean, even The Matrix is the same way, right?
Yeah.
There's like an action scene.
There's an action scene.
Like kind of setting up the mood and
yeah.
But
I'm going to talk about that.
But there are multiple scenes in Star Wars.
Yeah.
And we already have multiple main characters introduced way before Luke Skywalker.
Yeah.
It's surprising like how often Star Wars comes up as the ultimate example of this type of very classical hero formula. And now that I think about it, we have so many scenes and so many characters and so many situations introduced before we even see Luke for the first time.
Yeah, but I don't think that conflicts with this idea of, or like this standard hero's journey idea.
Yeah, I didn't mean it conflicts with it. It's just interesting. I never realized.
Yeah.
How much action is happening before we see Luke.
Yeah. And yeah, I think the reasons for that are the other things that need to happen in, or, you know, help if they happen in an act one, is that there's, mood setting, there's sort of range setting, which I'll kind of come back to. And then there's the larger meaning and opposing forces in the larger meaning that are outside the meaning for the main character, you know? The main character, the hero, is like your proxy in this world, but the world is also a much bigger part of the story, or it's part of the story that it's not like tangential. It's just like, this is the meat of the story as well, you know? So I'm going to just go back to The Matrix. So there's the way that The Matrix kind of builds to the end of Act One is that he has to make choices at sort of steady intervals throughout Act One. And each time he makes a choice, he takes on more and more risk. And that kind of prepares us for the final choice that he makes. So that by the time he gets there, we're like completely ready for that. So like the first time he makes a choice, his boss says, you know, are you going to stay at this job or are you going to leave? And he chooses the safe option and he stays at the job. And then the second choice he has to make is like Morpheus is telling him to go out on the scaffold to escape Mr. Smith. And he starts to go out, but then he gets freaked out and he goes back inside. And so he's also taking the safe option, but he's a little bit more willing to consider the risk. And then he chooses not to cooperate with Mr. Smith. And
she meant Agent Smith, just for the trolls.
Doesn't he call himself Mr. Smith?
Agent Smith and Mr. Anderson.
Oh, that's why. Thanks. Only our friends are going to listen to this. It's fine. Don't at me.
I think we can leave this in and you just, with my comment, and you just switch to Agent Smith.
Oh, you think Anderson. I'm going to take it out?
I don't know.
You think I'm afraid?
No. I'm just suggesting something that you might do.
I'm not ashamed.
Good. You shouldn't be.
So yeah, he chooses not to cooperate with Agent Smith. And he thinks he can get away with it, and he says like, "Oh, I know my rights." Or whatever. So it's slightly risky, but he doesn't realize how big a risk it is. And then he puts the thing in his stomach with seals his mouth and does that whole freaky thing. So then he's like, oh, okay, this is bigger risk than I realized. And then
all the fans who know those gadgets by the name,
mm-hmm.
Good for y'all.
Yeah. You're really anticipating the nerd storm.
I mean, it's huge. I'm well aware of how huge the nerd storm is.
Like, if anyone is listening to this and if anyone is patiently listening to me talk through the narrative beats of The Matrix, then they are tolerant enough of this intro level of expertise.
You would be surprised, but sure. You clearly don't read enough comments.
Yeah. That's one thing it's I know that you are an expert in, yeah, is YouTube amazing. Comments.
It's amazing how much valuable content you can provide and people still going to focus on the nerdy, irrelevant details.
But, you know, you can't leave comments on a podcast, so.
Which is great.
So there.
Let's move on.
We don't have time for 20 questions.
Okay, and then the fourth thing is he chooses to meet with Morpheus after the whole Agent Smith situation, which is like, by then he knows it's risky, although he thought that the thing was a dream, but whatever. And then the fifth one is that he chooses to stay in the car with Morpheus and Trinity, realizing that it is very risky. And then finally, the final choice with the pill thing is the last full risk that he takes. But each time the characters very explicitly say things like, you have a choice, which you choose. It's very, very obvious what's happening. And like they literally say, our way or the highway. At one point.
I remember that quote.
Right now, there's only one rule. Our way or the highway?
I would also maybe add a soundbite from Fred Durst of Limp Bizkit. Because whenever they say our way or the highway, always reminds me of that horrible Limp Bizkit song, My Way or the Highway.
There's also an Usher song called My Way.
And there's a Sinatra song called My Way.
I mean, I know that The Matrix was a super mainstream movie, but it was also very edgy at the time. And, you know, just kind of a lesson from this is, like, as we were sort of discussing earlier, like, you don't have to be, you know, a movie doesn't have to be straying very far from this narrative structure to be edgy or counterculture. Like, another mainstream but also kind of at the time edgy example would be like Fight Club.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like,
yeah,
it's same. Pretty much the same
the
thing.
The same thing, yeah.
But, you know, was very cool and felt very unique at the time.
I wonder if you're trying to make something edgy or something slightly more experimental, it's actually a very good foundation to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can probably experiment with a lot of visuals, with interesting characters, interesting scenarios, but as long as you stick to this formula,
mm-hmm.
the audience is going to get it.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can get away with a lot of weird shit.
Yeah.
Just by applying the hero's journey.
Yeah. Yeah, like, the subject matter is enough. And the style, yeah, like, if you take The Matrix, the subject matter, the style is doing a lot. You know, you don't have to also have some sort of crazy narrative that's all over the place.
Yeah.
I think just the, you know, just the topic of leaving and disrupting your daily grind, the boring day job life, for something different is enough of a statement, which is funny. Even that feels so cliche at this point, but, you know, it's, I mean, that's the exact same message in The Matrix. He's at this boring office job and, like, he's willing to do this, like, this thing which is clearly extremely dangerous and fucked up. He's willing to do that just to avoid a 9-to-5 office job, you know? Like, it's not like the alternative is death. The alternative is just regular life.
Yeah, because that was the biggest struggle in the 90s. The 9-to-5 job.
You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes.
That's what The Matrix is about. That's what Fight Club is about. Yeah. That's what American Beauty is about.
Yep. Office Space.
Office Space. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. Welcome to post-Cold War, pre-9/11 cinema.
Yeah. Like, those are the stakes.
Yeah.
Those are the only stakes you need.
The day job.
The day job.
A prison for your mind.
I love how much of a, like, nerd fantasy The Matrix is, because, you know, he goes to this, like, or he's, like, in a club or something. I don't remember why.
Yeah, there's a club scene with lame music and horrible costumes.
But, like, you know, this, like, hot girl, Trinity, comes up to him and is like, I know there's a secret, deep, important reason that you've been on your computer night after night. You know, like, that's like what every nerd wants to hear, you know?
Exactly.
They're, you know.
I know exactly why you're on Reddit every night.
Yeah.
I've been following your MySpace. And you're awesome.
Take off your shirt.
What?
Okay, so that's creating meaning for the main character. But there's also sort of that greater meaning, which is happening at the same time. So in, yeah, like Star Wars, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, it's all about, you know, hope, good versus evil, fighting for what's right despite the odds, goodness, love, kindness, valuing our unique strengths versus power, greed, corruption. And it's kind of the light and dark within everyone, blah, blah, blah. So, to take a more fun example, Jurassic Park.
How do you know they're all female? Did somebody go out in the park and pull up the dinosaur skirts?
So the themes are also not exactly subtle in this one. You have like playing God, technology, the whole kind of like Pygmalion Frankenstein thing, which is represented by the Richard Attenborough character, who's just like really pumped about the whole potential of Jurassic Park and, you know, thinks that he can just control it. It's all going to be great and awesome. And then also on, he's kind of on the bad but naive side. And then there's sort of also on the bad side would be like greed and evil corporations, which is represented by the like insurance dude who just wants to make lots of money and keeps commenting on how much money they're going to make. And the whole like subplot with the Newman from Seinfeld guy, the big fat dude. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about, right?
You mean the differently skinny dude?
Yes.
Don't call him fat.
The first. And then on the other side.
I can't afford to be canceled after the first episode for fat shaming.
We've already lost, you know, all three of our listeners by now anyway, so. And then on the other side, you know, nature, the natural order of things, humility before what nature can do. And you've got on that side, like that main guy, whatever his name is, and Laura Dern and Jeff Goldblum. And then that really like intense safari looking dude who keeps being like, dinosaurs are really scary.
I mean, the hunter.
Yeah.
The safari looking dude is a hunter.
Yeah. Safari looking dude. The guy in the khakis. Wait, a hunter?
Isn't he a hunter?
What is he, hunting dinosaurs?
I mean, he's the one who can kill the dinosaurs because everybody else is an intellectual. They can't do shit.
Yeah, what is his actual job?
His job is just to make sure that the dinosaurs are not killing humans. So he's the one who
kills. So he's doing a really bad job, basically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, he's wearing cargo pants and carries a gun. He's basically the Republican.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, this is before.
Before Republicans?
No, this is when we could all be united behind Jeff Goldblum. Together.
True, true, very true.
Do you remember we watched this thing called Endings, the Good, the Bad, and the Insanely Great? And it's by the guy who wrote Little Miss Sunshine. Anyway, listeners, I recommend checking it out if you're interested in this. Because he does a really good job of breaking down this kind of structure. So he kind of calls the moment, I don't know anything about opera, but he calls the moment when like the good and bad characters are sort of just stating the meaning of the movie outright, the aria. I guess that has some meaning in opera, but I kind of liked it anyway, because I think it kind of indicates the point, which is that they're sort of stepping out in front of everyone and telling you, the audience, you know, what the movie is saying. And it's very explicit. So like in Jurassic Park, Jeff Goldblum gives that speech where he says,
I'm simply saying that life finds a way.
And, or less subtly, he also just says,
gee, the lack of humility before nature that's being displayed here staggers me.
And, you know, people like in this movie, in Jurassic Park, they say basically exactly how they feel and what they stand for. Like one of the main guys, like one of his first lines is, I hate computers.
I hate computers.
Feelings mutual.
To go back to The Matrix, the main difference is about, like we were talking about earlier, not living your boring life as one of the sheeple. You know, ignorance is bliss versus knowing the truth, but then it's opening that whole can of worms. But there's literally a point where Neo is deciding between turning back or going with Morpheus and Trinity, and he looks out at the rainy road and Trinity says,
because you have been down there, Neo,
You know that road. You know exactly where it ends. And I know that's not where you want to be.
Again, just characters very explicitly stating what this movie is about. But it's effective at creating meaning and investing us in the plot, which is the point. So I already mentioned how in The Matrix there's this choice rhythm, and in each he's a little more willing to take on more risk. So that's when he gets to the scene with the pills, it's totally believable that he would make that choice. But there are other ways that films can establish a pattern of escalation in Act One. So I want to take Rambo as an example.
You mean First Blood?
First Blood. So just to kind of talk through the escalation that happens. So at first he's shunned, and then he's escorted out of town and taken to jail. And then from there, they literally start hunting him, and then they shoot at him to kill. And we kind of see his resistance go from passive resistance to aggression. So then by the time that he throws a rock at the helicopter and accidentally kills someone, we're empathetic to him because we understand how he got there. And after that, when he kind of goes full Rambo on the town, we understand why, because he literally has nothing to lose and he's just like an animal that's been cornered. Another fun way that I've noticed the movies can escalate in Act One is kind of by not escalating at all. Basically, instead, they just juxtapose everything going perfectly well for the main characters with the surrounding sense of danger. So this kind of happens in Jurassic Park. Like, for a very long time, we keep saying how dangerous the dinosaurs are, but everything is actually going perfectly well for the main characters. And we're just kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop. We know it's going to happen, but it kind of builds the suspense that mm-hmm. way, rather than having an escalation actually occur.
Mm-hmm.
Another movie that does this is Goodfellas.
I said, all right, I'll tell you something. Go fuck your mother.
Which I'll talk more about later. But the main character is surrounded by all these like really grisly murders. But for him, everything is actually going perfectly well for a pretty long time in the movie. There's even that great scene with Joe Pesci when he keeps saying,
funny how.
Funny how.
What do you mean funny? Funny how? How am I funny?
Yeah. How am I funny? And you're like, he's about to lose it.
How the fuck am I funny? What the fuck is so funny about me?
You know, you're just like, oh, fuck, here we go. And it's just a really effective way to foreshadow and build tension.
You motherfucker! I almost had him!
Actually, both Jurassic Park and Goodfellas start with a really intense first scene that tells you exactly how bad things can get for a person in the world of the movie. So in Jurassic Park, and I kind of forgot this, definitely makes me think of how family movies have changed over time. There's like the first scene, like a guy gets his legs torn off by a dinosaur.
Yeah.
And in Goodfellas, it's the scene with they're driving, they hear knocking on the trunk, they get out and they open up the trunk and the guy's in there. And for a second you think, maybe they don't know that there's someone in their trunk or like what's going on here. And then Joe Pesci just stabs him and shoots him multiple times. But it's really smart because now you have that in your mind for the rest of Act One. So now everything goes back to being peaceful and happy and good. But in the back of your mind, you're thinking, okay, I know how bad it could get. Also, yeah, Jurassic Park, The Matrix, Goodfellas, Lord of the Rings, they all start with a really intense action scene, followed by almost 30 or 40 minutes of complete calm. So it's just a way that they can establish the tone right up front. And probably also just a way to engage people in the story, you know, tell them what kind of movie they're about to watch. Like, you're about to watch an action movie. Whereas Rambo, like, gets to the action pretty fast, but doesn't start with action. Because it is an action movie, it has to quickly go through Act One in a much more compressed timeline to mm-hmm. get to that action. Okay. Not to get too, again, scientific about this structure, but just to talk about sort of timing for a second. It is kind of interesting how consistent these movies are when it comes to the length of Act One. The sort of standard advice time that you get is they'll say 30 minutes is when Act One should end. But I've actually found it to be a bit longer in most of these movies, which is probably more true for newer films, since they do tend to be longer these days.
Mm-hmm.
The Matrix is almost exactly 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 29 minutes and 40 seconds or something when he takes the pill.
But so far, that's the most textbook definition.
That's the most textbook,
of this whole narrative. And then there's a very good recent example, Don't Worry, Darling,
mm-hmm.
which definitely had, we already saw a mm-hmm. lot of boring ass filler scenes in the first 30 to 40 minutes. Like when you're just supposed to like set up what the situation is. And we saw so much boring fillers already.
Well, that's something I was thinking about when we were watching it, which I wanted to come back to. Like, so Act One in Don't Worry, Darling, should end when she gets to the, or when she sees the plane, she runs to the, you know, headquarters.
Yeah.
Like, and she makes the decision. That's kind of like her moment of deciding to engage this, right?
Pretty much. Mm-hmm.
But after that point, we get all of this, like, weird, that all those like moments of like her noticing that something weird is going on.
Yeah.
And that's what I find weird. That's what I find that doesn't work about it. They should have put all that before she, you know, then once she gets to the headquarters, that's when we should switch gears. And now it's about her, like what you were saying, figuring out who she can trust, trying to figure out how she's going to get out of this thing, getting more information, not just experiencing more weird shit, but trying to go on with her normal life. She's already chosen at that point that she's not going to go on with her normal life.
Yeah, it feels like two act ones back to back.
Yeah, it's like an act one and a half.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point. It's one of those really annoying scenarios when I can tell the intention of the creator.
Yeah.
Not because it worked.
Yeah.
I just put it together that, oh, this is supposed to be surreal. I get it.
Yeah. In Jurassic Park, it's around 40 minutes too when they finally actually get in the Jeeps and start the ride of the park, which is that moment of, okay, here we go. Do you remember what Sam Jackson says?
I don't know, but I assume he didn't say motherfucker, which is quite unusual for him. What did he say?
He says,
hold on to your butts.
Yeah, that's a PG-13 Sam Jackson.
Yeah. But that's how, that's the line Act One ends with in Jurassic Park.
That's a great way to end Act One.
Yeah. And that's always a pretty good indication of when Act One is ending, when someone says something like, here goes nothing, or, you know, they take a deep breath and then the plunge. You know, you can kind of remember that.
Yeah.
One cliche, which I noticed at, I rewatched The Hunt, or I rewatched the beginning of The Hunt for Red October. Did you ever see that?
Of course I did.
Oh, you have? Okay.
Red October standing by.
Yeah. The Scottish-Russian.
Scottish-Russian. We're Russians, all Scottish.
I remember not really liking it very much. which is why I watched it, because I was trying to see if there, it was something about Act One that made me not like it. Mm-hmm. But Act One was pretty standard, actually. Mm-hmm. So Alec Baldwin, who plays like some kind of submarine expert, is asked to help the American military hunt the submarine, the Red October, which is captained by Sean Connery. And then the cliche I'm referring to is that when he's asked to go on this mission, the music swells in suspense and there's a close-up on his face and then it cuts away. You know how that's like kind of a cliche where they'll be like, now you have to make a choice. What do you choose? And the music will be like, you know, and then it'll cut away.
Yeah.
But it's like, we know what he's going to decide, because if he doesn't go on the mission, then there's no movie. You look like you had something to say.
No. I just realized it's so interesting because, yeah, just us discussing Act One already revealed something very very clumsy or problematic about Don't Worry, Darling. It was, you know, it was such a useful conversation if we're nothing else for that.
Good.
Yeah, like the first hour should have been combined in the, you know, like as the first 30 minutes.
30 minutes, yeah. Yeah, that's what I was saying. Like, it's not that the movie, if a movie doesn't follow the structure, that it's going to be necessarily like laughably bad or confusing. It's just going to be boring.
Yeah.
Because there's no meaning driving what's happening and there's no inertia.
Yeah. It's one of those rules that you have to really understand, and you need a very good reason to change it or go against it on purpose.
Yeah.
And if you don't have a good reason, then just don't do it, because you're only making your work boring, but not any more interesting.
Okay, so the standard hero's journey myth would say that the main character has to make a choice that they can't turn back from. And that choice will dictate the rest of the events of the movie. Everything will go back to that decision. So sometimes, like in The Matrix, they'll literally say this outright. Morpheus actually says, after this, there is no turning back. Kind of another side note, but, and this is another little quiz question for you. Can you think of what children's book / animated movie seems to be the most likely reference for its most highly referenced for its Act One? It's in The Matrix.
Alice in Wonderland?
Yeah. Great job.
You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Also the character in Don't Worry, Darling, her name is Alice.
Ooh, that's deep. As deep as a rabbit hole. Oh my god, they seriously dared to call her Alice.
Yeah.
Give me a break.
So The Matrix references it a bunch of times, and another animated movie that I watched for this podcast also references it, which is My Neighbor Totoro.
Ooh.
May, the main little toddler girl, sees a little white Totoro, which very closely resembles a white rabbit, and she follows it to a hole, and she jumps down after it, and that's where she meets the main Totoro.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, happens at almost exactly 30 minutes in the movie as well.
And it's a great movie.
Just to bring it full circle, and it's a great movie. So, yeah, that's just one way that Act One can end, is this choice thing. But I'm going to explore a couple other ways. One thing I noticed even in hero's journey type stories is that there's supposed to be like a resistance, or what they call the refusal of the call, which is like where the main character is reluctant or initially doesn't accept the journey or the quest. But actually, there's a lot of movies where they don't hesitate or think about it at all. They just kind of jump right in, like in Alice in Wonderland, she just jumps right in the hole. She doesn't think for 2 seconds. It even says, like, it's, she jumps in faster than she can even think about how to get out.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the same with Mei and Totoro, actually. She barely hesitates before going in. She just kind of jumps right in. But anyway, this, like, lack of reluctant, or, like, the idea that you have to be reluctant or you have to have all the information and fully kind of deliberate your decision before making it is kind of less true to life in some ways, because, like, we don't always realize when we're at the precipice of a decision. And we don't realize how consequential that moment was usually until much later. And, you know, sort of after there's already a huge psychological sunk cost. And then we have to decide, you know, if we want to give up after a huge investment, sort of. So just rarely do we know we're about to make a big decision and have one defining moment when we make it with all of the information in front of us. So I think it's just more actually kind of true to life that you jump in without realizing what is actually at stake.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important that we, the audience, understand what's at stake.
Mm-hmm.
Or we have some sense, or some sense of maybe foreboding or, you know, meaning, even if the main character doesn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
Like in Lord of the Rings, for example, like we're seeing all this other stuff that Frodo is not seeing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So we're getting a lot of information that he doesn't have.
Yeah.
But then you can compare the sort of absence of reluctance from Frodo or Mei or Alice in Wonderland to Neo or Rambo, whose first act is all about reluctance and resisting and refusing the call. Like, that's their entire journey in Act One.
Mm-hmm.
Act One doesn't necessarily always have this, like, clear definitive ending point, but it does hinge on a narrative turning point. So, like, for example, in Goodfellas, we see Ray Liotta's character rise through the ranks and have success while the presence of danger is all around him, and we're nervous, kind of anticipating that the danger is going to come from around him. But he himself only de-escalates each situation that he's in. And that way he stays kind of insulated from the danger, including the funny how scene. He's just de-escalating.
You know, it's a good story. It's funny. You're a funny guy.
However, around the 30-minute mark, he starts to push those boundaries because of his powerful position. And that's when we start to see things go wrong for him.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, in Rambo, there's this pretty long turning point, sort of like a long end to Act One, while Rambo is being forced into more and more on the offense in order to defend himself. So, yeah, he breaks out of the jail, then he throws the rock, then he, like, injures a bunch of cops but doesn't kill them intentionally. He's like, I could have killed them. And that shifting happens, like, from minute 20 to minute 50, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's like a long switch from Act 1 to Act 2.
Mm-hmm. Something just reminded me of tricky Act 1s, mm-hmm. or, like, not very Act 1-esque
mm-hmm.
Act 1s.
Uh-huh.
And what I was remembering, yeah, like, how about movies like Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs? There are scenes that are kind of setting up the tone,
mm-hmm.
but because the story is so unlinear,
mm-hmm.
and there are so many characters
mm-hmm.
that are often not even interacting with each other, especially in Pulp Fiction,
mm-hmm.
like, how does this whole Act 1 thing works in Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction?
It's been a long time since I watched Pulp Fiction. I bet I could tie it in if I watched it again.
Probably.
I think you are setting up the narrative, but I'd have to rewatch it, mm-hmm. which I might do now yeah. that you said that. But because
I'm just trying to think, like, okay, like what types of movies are what yeah. types of movies work slightly differently
yeah, yeah,
in
yeah.
the sense no, of Act One and
yeah,
and probably Pulp Fiction is a good example of that.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, basically to sum up, like, I don't want to make it sound like there's only one way to judge a good story, and I hope that's not what it sounds like I'm saying. I think it's just a helpful jumping off point and a good template for understanding how or why a story works or doesn't work, especially one that's clearly going for a straightforward narrative technique, as most films do still tend to do. Existing in our Western society, we've all been kind of indoctrinated subconsciously with a classic format. So an audience is always referring back to that, subconsciously referencing it, just as listeners of a piece of modern music would be sort of automatically referencing the scale we use when they're listening to something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so to sum up, create meaning, bring us along in the decision-making process of the characters, present us with the range of worldviews that are at stake here through these sort of aria moments, present us with a range of how good and, you know, how good things can get, how bad things can be. The main character doesn't necessarily need to know how bad things can be or how important the decision they're making is. But I think we, as the audience, kind of need to know that, or it helps, to create the stakes, create some sense of danger. And I think at some point, you know, sooner rather than later, better if it's closer to 30 minutes, creating a narrative turn that's meaningful and hinges on that meaning that's been created. That's those are kind of the basics mm-hmm. of Act One.
Yeah.
So in the next few episodes, I want to talk about exposition, both direct exposition through, like, voiceover, for example, also indirect exposition through, like, dialogue. Mm-hmm. We'll also roast some Act Ones that really sucked, and, which we've already done a little of.
Yeah.
Yeah, some of the issues that come up frequently in mm-hmm. Act One situations. And we'll, you know, do a little kind of close reading of certain scenes as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, sounds great.
Great.
I can't wait.
I'm so excited. Thanks for listening to Postscript. The music for this episode was created by my brother, Graham. If you want to reach any of us, you can email postscriptcast@gmail.com.
I'm David, the boyfriend.